trans care, where we have Alabama that's passed a law, we have Arkansas now, we have courts deciding what can and can't happen. At the end of the day, we know that this care is safe. We know that, and I say this as a physician who provides this care, who's trained in providing this care, this trans care is life-saving. It reduces people's ability, it reduces people's suicidality, it saves people's lives. It's important to have people be able to access this care, especially minors. And what we're seeing with the opposition is that they're targeting folks in southern states and targeting the most vulnerable among us. In this case, it's children. And so, again, this is another issue that's very closely linked to anti-abortion movements, where folks that support anti-abortion laws also support these anti-trans laws. At the end of the day, for me as a physician, these decisions should be left between me, my patients. We should use science and medicine and counsel our patients on what's best for them and let them decide what they want to do with their lives and their bodies and uphold their dignity and humanity.
And I'd like to bring Mini Tamaraju back into the conversation. The recent decision, I think it was on Wednesday, by a federal judge in Idaho, blocking portions of a trigger ban on abortions. Could you talk about that?
Sure. In Idaho, the Department of Justice brought suit on the provision, on EMTALA, the emergency care provision piece. And look, in Idaho, the court did say, look, the ban is still in place, which is deeply problematic. But a good step is that now, if a patient, again, has to prove it, and the doctor has to prove it, so it's not ideal, but if a patient can prove that they have an emergency, they can have access in an emergency room to abortion care. For all the reasons Dr. Kumar just laid out, this is still very problematic, but it's an important first step because this is an example of how the Biden administration is taking a strong stance for reproductive freedom and reproductive rights and trying to use all the tools in their toolbox, particularly the DOJ, to intervene in some of these most problematic cases.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. There's so much to talk about, and we will continue to. Mini Tamaraju is president of NARAL Pro-Choice America. She's speaking to us from Philadelphia. And Dr. Bhavik Kumar is the medical director of primary and trans care at Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast in Houston. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a people and culture manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm in West Lynn. Portland Tycho blends traditional Japanese taiko drumming with dynamic choreography and storytelling. That's Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm, 29700 Southwest Mountain Road in West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, independent candidate Betsy Johnson qualifies for the Oregon governor ballot. The search warrant affidavit for the FBI raid on Trump's Mar-a-Lago home is unsealed. And an Oregon peak called Swastika Mountain will be renamed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 26th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Betsy Johnson is officially an Oregonian gubernatorial candidate. State elections officials announced yesterday that she had submitted more than the 23,744 signatures needed to appear on the November ballot as an unaffiliated candidate. Johnson will face Democrat Tina Kotek and Republican Christine Drazen in a three-way race. Many predicted that Johnson would be successful in qualifying for the ballot. Most unaffiliated and third-party candidates have less of a chance of having any impact on an election based on the two-party system that dominates American politics. But Johnson was a former Democratic state senator. She has years of experience in state politics and strong connections to important political players. She has been aggressively campaigning and fundraising for months, even before getting confirmation her name would be on the ballot. Johnson has raised more than both Kotek and Drazen so far, with help from well-known donors such as Nike co-founder Phil Knight and Columbia Sportswear CEO Tim Boyle. She has endorsements from former Republican and Democratic elected officials, as well as many of the state's major law enforcement organizations. Johnson began collecting signatures in June. She spent nearly $350,000 on the effort and has reportedly raised more than $10.5 million for her campaign. In fact, Johnson has collected more than twice as many signatures as the state requires to secure a spot on the ballot. Johnson says she's running a nonpartisan, politically centrist campaign. She allegedly aims to attract Republicans who formerly had little chance of electing a party-affiliated candidate and disaffected Democrats upset by issues like crime and houselessness. It is unclear whether Johnson's candidacy, if unsuccessful, will siphon more votes from Kotek or Drazen, and her ultimate impact on the election is difficult to predict. Johnson said, quote, "This is a momentous day for Oregon. We have an incredible opportunity this year to reject the extremes and elect an independent governor who will put Oregonians first," end quote. The search warrant affidavit that the FBI used to search and seize documents from former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home was released, with some redactions. There's been a lot of pressure, both from media outlets and conservative groups, to unseal and share the documents federal law enforcement compiled to justify their search. The affidavit was unsealed by a federal judge Friday, with some redactions. The black marks block out references to witnesses, law enforcement agents, people not being charged with the crime, plus the strategies of the investigation and grand jury information. It showed that Trump had been storing highly classified information in an unsecured storage room at Mar-a-Lago, and that federal authorities from the Department of Justice and the National Archives tried to reclaim documents multiple times before the search. Trump's lawyers also had the opportunity to argue against an FBI search before it happened, warning that the optics of the search would be negative for the sitting president. Trump's lawyers also claimed that the president has the absolute authority to declassify documents, but it is not established that former presidents can do so. Even if Trump had declassified those documents, there would have had to be a paper trail of evidence confirming he made that effort while in office. Department of Justice agents toured the premises before the search and pushed Trump to put a lock on the storage room door. The search warrant also said that many highly sensitive documents were loose, unlabeled, or mixed in with other materials. 184 documents were recovered, according to the affidavit, including 25 considered top secret. The documents are related to an ongoing investigation related to violation of the Espionage Act, which prohibits sharing national defense information, but also storing it away from official sources. The affidavit read that at Mar-a-Lago, quote, "probable cause exists to believe that evidence, contraband, fruits of crime, or other items illegally possessed," end quote, would be there. The affidavit detailing the search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago home released today, and former Attorney General Bill Barr accuses the former president of extorting the GOP. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Much of our work is by necessity conducted out of the public eye. We do that to protect the constitutional rights of all Americans and to protect the integrity of our investigations.
A federal judge agreed with Attorney General Merrick Garland's stance there were valid reasons to obscure details of the FBI search warrant in the search of former President Donald Trump's home. A redacted version submitted by the Justice Department must be released to the public by noon today, Trump is being investigated for potentially obstructing justice and violating records laws regarding documents taken from the White House. A newly released legal memo shows that former Attorney General Bill Barr argued Trump's actions during Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Trump-Russia investigation did not warrant prosecution for obstruction of justice. In an interview Thursday, Barr said he had no regrets about his decision. However, he accused Trump of using extortion to purge people from the Republican Party he doesn't like.
If it's not me, I'm going to ruin your election chances by telling my base to sit home, and I'll sabotage whoever you nominate other than me. And that shows what he's all about. He's all about himself.
In Georgia, the district attorney investigating Trump's attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election ordered former Trump chief of staff Mark Meadows to testify. Meadows traveled to Georgia during the state's recount effort. The DA is also seeking an appearance from attorney Sidney Powell, who helped drive claims about voter fraud and helped mount challenges to election results in several states. Despite attacks from critics that President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan will add to the deficit and increase inflation, the White House has been unable to provide a price tag. White House domestic policy advisor Susan Rice said it depends on the numbers.
Unfortunately, and we're here to encourage as many people to take it up as possible. If 43 million borrowers take it up, that'll be different than if 50% of those 43 million take it up.
Biden announced his administration is forgiving up to $10,000 in federal student loan debt for borrowers making less than $125,000 annually, and $20,000 in loans for Pell Grant recipients. A memorandum from the White House calls for all federally funded research to be made available to the public for free upon publication by 2026. The administration says it will improve access by ending the optional 12-month embargo, allowing journals to put work behind a year-long paywall.
We will be the first jurisdiction in the world to require all new cars to be sold to be alternative fuel.
California Governor Gavin Newsom announced a rule requiring 35% of new cars sold in the state to be zero emissions by 2026, increasing to 100% by 2035. Electric vehicles account for 15% of vehicle sales in California. Critics worry about additional charging infrastructure and argue the energy needed will strain the state's power grid. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An Oregon peak called Swastika Mountain near Cottage Grove in the Umpqua National Forest will be getting a new name early next year. The peak was named for a local town called Swastika, now gone, that was named for the symbol a local rancher used to brand his cattle. This was in the early 1900s, before the swastika became a symbol of genocide used in Nazi Germany. Reportedly, the rancher used the symbol because of its meaning in Sanskrit, good luck, or well-being. The modern connotation motivated locals to ask the Oregon Geographic Names Board to rename the mountain. But why did the name last so long? Locals speculate that since the peak is so remote, its name and the connotation it took on escaped notice for some time. One suggestion was to rename the peak Umpqua Mountain for the Umpqua River in the National Forest. Another, and the prevailing idea, is to rename the peak Halo Mountain after a nickname of a chief of the nearby Yankala Kalapuya tribe, Chief Halito, who lived in the late 1800s. The name change has wide support, but because of laws limiting the time period, it will take until the end of the year. Rural communities struggle to get federal dollars, like from grants. A $1 billion program in the recently passed CHIPS Act is expected to help them. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story in Idaho.
A program approved by Congress aims to give rural communities a leg up when applying for federal dollars. The CHIPS Act, passed last month, boosts semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. It also includes a $1 billion pilot program to help distressed communities apply for economic development funds. Jerry Miller with the Idaho Department of Commerce says the biggest hurdle to federal dollars for rural cities is often a lack of staff. He notes it's going to be critical that they have the capacity in coming months because big spending packages have recently passed in Congress.
With the infrastructure bill, there's going to be a lot of programs that are opening up all at once, and they're going to have similar deadlines, overlapping deadlines, and that could be pretty tough for a single person who this isn't even their full-time job to do.
Miller says organizations like the Local Infrastructure Hub are helping small and mid-sized cities apply for infrastructure grants. The pilot program in the CHIPS Act is based on legislation known as the Recompete Act, written by Representative Derek Kilmer, a Democratic House member from Washington State. Matt Hildreth, head of ruralorganizing.org, says big cities typically are first in line for federal grants, but he believes this program could change that.
It allows local leaders to have the flexibility they need to invest in the challenges that they see in their specific community. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It is a locally led approach.
He notes the vast majority of communities classified as economically distressed are rural. Hildreth notes each place has different development needs, from more broadband to help transitioning between industries. He says under this pilot, communities will guide the investments.
It targets funds specifically to small towns and rural communities and communities across the country that are economically distressed and ensures that they have a shot at getting access to those federal funds as well.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A recent report from the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy finds that crisis pregnancy centers often deceive clients who are seeking abortion care. They also found that the crisis pregnancy centers are extremely well-funded by larger social service organizations, often with ties to the anti-abortion movement. Suzanne Potter has the details on the report.
In the wake of the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, crisis pregnancy centers are drawing more scrutiny. In June, California Attorney General Rob Bonta warned that CPCs advertise reproductive health care services, but their true mission is to dissuade people from seeking an abortion. Stephanie Pang with the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy says CPCs sometimes make false claims about the risks of the procedure.
There are really intentional practices to lure people who are seeking abortion information and then really mislead them away from having an abortion without giving them a choice to even think about it.
Supporters of crisis pregnancy centers say they help pregnant people by offering free services such as diapers and breastfeeding classes. State data show that 179 CPCs operate in California. A recent report from the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy looked at IRS records and found that CPCs and their tax-affiliated organizations took in $4 billion from 2015 to 2019. Peng says CPCs often have ties to much larger organizations, many affiliated with the Right to Life movement.
There's this common misconception that CPCs are just really small, individual-run organizations that are all volunteer-based. They might be operating out of a church. But what we found is that $4 billion is a substantial amount of revenue that they are getting.
The report recommends that charitable donors and foundations check to see if the organizations they support are funneling money to CPCs. 14 states moved to ban or severely restrict abortion since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade earlier this summer. Peng says donors concerned about the right to choose may want to contribute to groups that help low-income women who may have to travel out of state for the procedure.
The philanthropy and foundation sector really needs to support the local and state-based abortion funds, who are really providing the financial and practical assistance to individuals who are seeking abortion care.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. It's 6, it's the Magical Mystery Tour. Then it's 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy, with an overnight low of 58. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy, with a high of 73. Today in history, it's Women's Equality Day in the United States, commemorating the adoption of the 19th Amendment in 1920, which gave women the right to vote. The quote of the day is from former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who said, quote, "Gender equality is more than a goal in itself. It is a precondition for meeting the challenge of reducing poverty, promoting sustainable development, and building good governance." States across the U.S. are finally beginning to receive funds from the settlements with pharmaceutical companies who manufactured the opioid crisis. Oregon is set to get $333 million over the next 18 years, starting this year. Funds will be directed to a variety of programs to help people who suffer from opioid addiction. The same is happening in Ohio. Mary Sherman speaks with Beth Macy, the author of Dopesick, the best-selling book that examines the roots of the opioid crisis.
With more than $1 billion in opioid settlement dollars coming to Ohio, advocates say it must be directed to evidence-based strategies. Ohio ranked fourth among states in 2020 for drug overdose mortality, with a majority of deaths caused by opioids. Beth Macy authored the best-selling book Dopesick, which examines the origins of the opioid epidemic. She says real change can happen at the community level with a shift in mindset, and that addiction should be viewed as a treatable medical illness rather than a moral failure in crime.
In the middle of the worst drug epidemic in the nation's history, we need to start figuring out where all these bureaucratic, unnecessary hurdles are. Only 12% of folks with OUD even managed to get treatment in the last year. Of the wealthiest nation in the world, that's horrendous.
Ohio will get about $1 billion over 18 years in a major opioid settlement, but additional money is expected from pending lawsuits. Macy speaks Friday at the Prevention Action Alliance's annual breakfast in Columbus about her upcoming book, Raising Lazarus, which dives deeper into the issue of opioid addiction and highlights successful treatment practices. In her research, Macy discovered that the opioid epidemic landscape lacks coordination and structure, but she says some communities and organizations are seeing success.
Even if you have, say, a conservative community that maybe historically has only viewed addiction through a drug war lens, even some of those communities are figuring out how to make positive change.
Ohio's new Relapse Reduction Act increases penalties for selling drugs near treatment facilities and to those undergoing treatment. Opponents argue it approaches addiction as a crime. Macy says harm reduction practices, such as medications that stave off cravings or needle exchanges, can get people on the path to recovery.
Once they start to make these incremental changes, they can actually see, oh, maybe I can get better. But it's this matter of 40% of folks with opioid use disorder don't even want to try to get better because they've tried before and they've been stigmatized or they haven't been able to access it.
Sometimes it's as simple as needing a ride to a local clinic or getting help applying for Medicaid. She adds that expanding access to treatment medications is needed, noting that certain practitioners need special certification to prescribe medications to treat opioid use disorder. For Ohio News Connection, I'm Mary Sherman.
A school district in Missouri is bringing back spanking as a form of student discipline. The district had dropped the practice in 2001. Their parents have to agree to corporal punishment. The Cassville School District, located about 60 miles from Springfield, has about 1,900 students. Its policy states that corporal punishment will be used only when other forms of discipline have failed. A witness from the district must be present, and the discipline will not be used in front of other students. The superintendent also has to grant permission. Superintendent Merlin Johnson said the decision to revive corporal punishment came after an anonymous survey sent to parents, students, and school employees reported concerns with student behavior and discipline. Johnson said many parents had complained that the district did not use corporal punishment. He said, quote, "We've had people actually thank us for it. Surprisingly, those on social media would probably be appalled to hear us say these things, but the majority of people that I've run into have been supportive," end quote. The policy specifically states that corporal punishment must be administered so there can be no chance of bodily injury or harm, and that striking a student on the head or face is not permitted. Missouri is one of 19 states that allow corporal punishment in schools. Previous efforts to ban corporal punishment in schools failed in the state legislature. Missouri will not track which school districts allow corporal punishment, apparently because those decisions are made at the local level. The Navajo Nation has its first confirmed case of monkeypox. With that story and more, it's Daniel Montaño with National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Montaño in for Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez confirms the first case of monkeypox on the reservation. The infected person lives in McKinley County, New Mexico. A press release says vaccines for the virus are expected to come in next week. Health officials recommended vaccines only for people who have had close contact with someone who is infected or for those especially at risk. Nez established a monkeypox preparedness team in July that has been monitoring, planning, and coordinating precautionary steps in advance of the virus's arrival. It can take between 5 to 21 days for symptoms to develop, which start with muscle aches, fever, and exhaustion before a rash develops. Those who test positive should isolate and contact their doctor. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention counts nearly 17,000 monkeypox infections in the U.S. A federal ethics investigation concluded former Trump Interior Secretary Ryan Zanke and his chief of staff lied during an investigation into the department's decision to block two tribes from opening a casino. The report released Wednesday says the Office of the Inspector General found Zanke spoke with a senator from Nevada, consultants, and lobbyists for a rival casino before deciding to block the tribe's application. MGM Resorts International opposed the project because they were planning to open a casino of their own. When questioned by the OIG, however, Zanke denied speaking with anyone other than staff at the Interior Department. The Montana Free Press says the Mashantucket, Pequot, and Mohegan tribes wanted to open a casino in Connecticut on non-reservation land, which would require approval from the Interior. But the report says Zanke chose to return the application to the tribes, saying the decision was not within his jurisdiction. The report focused on whether or not Zanke and Scott Hommel, his chief of staff, accurately described the influences on their decision. This report comes on the heels of a similar one released in February that found Zanke had also misled investigators about a personal real estate deal with the chairman of oil giant Halliburton in Whitefish, Montana. Zanke is running for re-election to the U.S. House of Representatives for Montana this November and denied any wrongdoing in a response from his lawyers. He also asked the OIG not to release the findings until after the election. His lawyers say the timing of the OIG report is nothing more than a political smear. A federal appeals court ruling says Wisconsin can't force tribal members to pay property taxes on reservation land that once fell out of tribal hands. Danielle Kading reports.
A federal appeals court ruled the state can't tax tribal members on reservation lands that have changed hands without clear approval from Congress. The decision stems from a lawsuit filed by four tribes in 2018 against the state and around a dozen towns. The case was brought by the Red Cliff, Bad River, Lac du Flambeau, and Lac Da Ray bands of Lake Superior Chippewa. Lac du Flambeau tribal president John Johnson Sr. says the ruling is a big deal as tribes buy back lands.
For us here on the reservation, it might be 2 or 3 years of taxes, sometimes 10, 15 years of taxes that we're paying on this land before the BIA gets it and puts it back in the trust for us. So that's going to be a money saver for my tribe.
The tribes argued the 1854 treaty that set up the reservations provides tribal members immunity from taxation for all time. The state maintains it could tax lands on reservations if they were ever sold to non-tribal members. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers says they're reviewing the decision. The state has 90 days from the ruling to decide whether to appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
And I'm Daniel Montano.
A majority of people who are incarcerated in the United States are eligible to vote, but because they're in prison, it's often really difficult to do so. But the third largest jail system in the country, Harris County, Texas, near Houston, is taking steps to improve voting access for inmates after lots of pressure from advocates. Roz Brown has more.
Every election, thousands of people are disenfranchised from voting because they're incarcerated. But Houston's Harris County Jail has shown the two are not mutually exclusive. In 2021, a polling place was available at the jail for the first time. Major Philip Busquez with the Harris County Sheriff's Department says many of those incarcerated are pre-trial detainees and not serving a sentence for felony conviction, making them eligible to vote. He assumed implementation would be daunting, but says he was proved wrong.
Logistically, in a system this size, the third largest in the country, it wasn't as hard as we thought. We got it accomplished, and we've had four elections, and we're set up for the big election coming in November.
Researchers with the Sentencing Project have found the vast majority of those incarcerated are eligible to vote, but face significant barriers. In the past 25 years, half the states have expanded voting access to people with felony convictions. Opponents argue felons should not be allowed to vote while incarcerated because they say voting is a privilege, not an absolute right of citizenship. Jarrell Douglas with the Houston Justice Coalition was instrumental in bringing voting to the city's jail. He says just 13 of the 26 people eligible cast an in-person ballot for this year's primary, and while that's a small number, he believes it's a right that should be protected, and notes minority communities are primarily affected.
When we think of who's typically behind bars, it's disproportionately Black people and brown people. So expanding this access to those who otherwise would have access to the ballot is huge when it comes to expanding access to democracy.
Douglas believes jails could and even should serve as voting locations in all states.
There are high concentrations of people that are in jails every day, some 549,000 people on any given day that don't have access to the ballot just because they're in jail.
In addition to Houston, jails in Chicago, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. also have introduced polling places for those incarcerated on Election Day. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 26th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, Roz Brown, and Daniel Montaño. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've